Hi, welcome to Black History Deep Dives. This is my first episode. In this podcast, we will be talking about Black history around the globe and diving into various topics that I find interesting and I think that you should know about because they play a huge role in our modern historical context as Black people. So if you're interested in stories from around the diaspora for whatever reason, I encourage you to listen to this podcast. I'm so happy to have you along, and I want to thank you so much for listening. So before I get too far into this intro without letting you know what the heck is going to be going on, this is going to be part one of a three-part series where we will be talking about the genocide in the Belgian Congo. Some of you may have heard from various history memes or on social media about the genocide in the Congo where King Leopold killed 10 million people. And so this podcast, we will do a really deep dive on all the figures at play here, everything that happened, and we're going to take a very close look at this important moment in colonial African history. So if this sounds like something that is interesting to you, I encourage you to keep listening because I'm really going to give you everything that you need to know about it, as well as some sources where you can learn more and get even more details for yourself. My name is Arish, and this is Black History Deep Dives. So most Americans, as you can probably tell, I'm at least partly American, and most Americans don't think about the Congo. If they do, their most likely reference is The Heart of Darkness, a novel by Joseph Conrad, commonly assigned to high school English classes, including my own. So Joseph Conrad, while a brilliant writer, with the intention of portraying the plight of Central African peoples to solicit sympathy from his audience, definitely told the story of Heart of Darkness from a viewpoint that maintained that Africans were savages and Europeans were civilized, even as he was doing his best to shed light on evils perpetrated by Europeans in the country. And Joseph Conrad actually witnessed some of the events that we'll be talking about as they pertain to the genocide, and he was one of the Europeans who attempted to write about it. So this is what tends to be our first reference. And our second reference is basically viewing this part of Africa as an area that is wrought with conflict, overrun by warlords, backwards, damaged, permanently destroyed. But this doesn't paint the entire picture of a people, and it doesn't speak the truth to their history, because there is so much more than that. And a lot of times when we look at conflict in a contemporary context, there is a historical reason for why this conflict is taking place. When people erroneously assert that, you know, Africans born on the continent of Africa do not have a history that is equal in pain and weight to what descendants of Africans experienced via the transatlantic slave trade, for example, this speaks to the efficacy of the genocidal program that we'll be talking about in this series, because King Leopold II of Belgium and the entire country of Belgium, which we'll get into later, actually had a very active propaganda campaign to suppress and silence information on one of the largest genocides in human history. If you're looking for a Wikipedia summary of the genocide in the Congo, this is definitely not the right podcast for you, because this is going to be a really deep dive. I can't emphasize it enough. And this will be a deep dive into one of the most painful parts of human history as a whole. Because this isn't just about African history. Whenever we talk about a crime against humanity as large as genocide, and we'll get into both the crime against humanity part and the genocide part in further detail later, this actually affects all of humanity. So I'm going to really try to shy away from being overly graphic when it doesn't serve a purpose towards advancing the story. However, in some of the later episodes, you may find that some details may be disturbing. And I also want to remind you that while this is one story, that makes up the rich history of the Congolese people and the various ethnic groups living there, this is not the only story to tell. And I hope that as I continue this podcast, I will be able to share even more with you. And I do think that this story, while not the only story, is a story worth telling. We need to remember this so that one day when our grandchildren or our children say never again to genocide, they can actually mean it. So to understand what happened in the Congo, I'm going to roll you back to the very beginning of the story. We're going to talk about the pre-colonial era a little bit, and we're going to talk about what was here before the genocide and what will be here far into the future after all of us are unfortunately dead. And that is the land that makes up the Congo. So the geography and setting are actually very important to history because they actually shape many historical events. Jared Diamond in Guns, Germs, and Steel obviously kind of extrapolates on this theory a bit more, but there are also other historians who really emphasize the role that geography and setting play on various historical events. So for that reason, I'm going to go into a little bit of detail on the Congo. So the Congo River Basin lies on a plateau in the African interior. The western rim of this plateau is nearly 1,000 feet high, and in 220 miles, the river rapidly descends to sea level. So the drop and volume of this water is immense. In those 220 miles, there is as much hydroelectric potential as all the lakes and rivers of the United States combined, which is a lot. So 1/6 of the entire world's hydroelectric potential is thought to be contained in the Congo River, and the resource-rich nature of this area will be important not just in this episode, but when I reference Congo history in the future. So traversing the routes of this river involves hard work, braving rapids, treacherous heights, troughs, canyons, treacherous cliffs. It is not a very easy area to navigate. Naturally, this area teems with life, including the mosquito known to cause the endemic illness malaria. And this, again, will be important later on when we're talking about the genocide and the surrounding events. The Congo is home to many native species, including the African forest elephant, manatees, dugongs, hippos, and numerous species of fish that inhabit the river itself, and possibly more famously, several primates and mammal species that are of great interest to contemporary conservationists. Western myths about African civilization prior to sustained contact with European invasion forces involve a lot of faulty assumptions about the people who inhabited this beautiful, resource-rich land. But who were those first people? How did they live in the Congo? How and why were they victimized by the Europeans who killed 10 million of their people in such a short space of time? And why is this genocide often forgotten? So I'm going to answer all of these questions in this podcast, but first we're going to talk about the first civilization that we can have documentation of prior to European colonization, and this is the Kingdom of the Congo. So the Kingdom of the Congo was roughly 300 square miles, comprising territory that today lies in several countries, including Angola, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and the Republic of the Congo. This African kingdom existed for at least 100 years before sustained European contact, and the king was chosen by an assembly of clan leaders. The Kingdom of the Congo was inhabited by 2 to 3 million people, which is vitally important to our story later on, but also important to the general history and development of the region. So for a civilization or a kingdom to sustain 2 to 3 million people requires a very sophisticated society, with specialized labor such as ironwork, which was considered a profession of nobility at the time, as well as deep agricultural knowledge. 2 to 3 million people is a large number of mouths to feed. So there needed to be a sophisticated supply chain to maintain a population this large. The people inhabiting the Kingdom of the Congo were also very knowledgeable about husbandry and raised goats, pigs, and cattle. There was a 4-day week, which sounds pretty good to me, a lunar month with a holiday on the first day of said month, and distance measured by marching days. Polygamy was widely practiced, and there was a thoroughly developed civil service, including judges who specialized specifically in adultery, which sounds super specific, and other sophisticated and specific professions like that one. The king collected taxes and controlled currency. And I want to point out that this was an advanced civilization by the most Eurocentric measures. And this is not up for debate, really, but is a documented historic fact. The existence of this expansive kingdom of the Congo counters the narrative of African people as being backwards. And naturally, this kingdom did not account for all the ethnic groups living along the Congo River. But this narrative about African people and their inability to, quote, become civilized has been used to justify slavery and genocide of different African groups, and this narrative has been proven to be patently false. The Kingdom of the Congo only accounts for one kingdom in Africa and only 2 to 3 million people. Its existence and the records we have of a thriving society prior to European colonization point to a very disturbing truth, which underpins the subject we're going to be talking about in this series. This myth of backwards African people, juxtaposed with civilized Europeans, was created to justify not just the transatlantic slave trade, which we'll discuss momentarily, but to justify the genocide in the Congo and future plundering of the entire African continent. It is a myth of genocidaires, and it honestly doesn't have much of a place in contemporary discussion of African history and politics. In 1491, the sustained encounter with Europeans that would prove detrimental for the people of the Congo began with the arrival of a Portuguese explorer who made contact with the Congo king and began the relationship that would lead to an insatiable European desire for African slaves. The slave trade would begin the decimation of the Congo people and set the groundwork for the genocide in what later became known as the Belgian Congo. So now we get to talk about the slave trade, which is not the specific genocide that I'm going to be talking about in this series. However, the slave trade obviously had a very large impact on the Congo region and everything that happened in the future with the Belgian Congo. So there are a lot of people out there who have a very weird preoccupation with defending the transatlantic slave trade, and I honestly cannot figure out why. Like, what is your hot take? Slavery good? I don't get it. But we're going to address, we're going to talk about slavery. So slavery existed in the Congo Kingdom prior to European arrival. This is factual. Slaves were mostly prisoners of war, people in large amount of debt, and criminals. Slavery was a flexible system, not an entrenched caste system. However, slavery was still bad, with slaves potentially being subject to very brutal treatment. Despite this prior existence of slavery, the transatlantic slave trade uniquely damaged West Africa. And this is, I think, a very important point because the impact was uniquely bad, which is one of the ways it's differentiated. The existence of the slave trade in the first place opened the door for European horrors to be unleashed onto the continent. The lust for more African bodies to enslave, however, was new and unique to the transatlantic slave trade. So in the Congo, Firstly, slavery wasn't based upon a racial identity or phenotype. And secondly, the sheer number of slaves required to maintain the European thirst for free labor was definitely unprecedented and utterly destroyed West African societies and civilizations along the entire west coast of Africa, not just the Congo. And this may surprise people, but all slavery can be wrong. So I'm not trying to bring this up to debate whether one slavery, who did the worst slavery, or whether African people are to blame for the transatlantic slave trade, because what is the point of that? What would that achieve? Honestly, nothing. But I want to account for this unprecedented historic event, which gutted an entire region of its artisans, merchants, healers, farmers, so many different people who made up the fabric of society, and it was a long-term historic event which destroyed families and left scars throughout the African diaspora, if not wounds that are still bleeding to this day. And this began with the Portuguese. In 1491, Diogo Cao's landfall happened, and Portuguese explorers forged relationships with the Congo king, a man named Zigbemba Afonso I. He took a Christian name later on. When the Portuguese landed in Brazil, so we're moving over to Brazil for a moment, the lust for slaves began, and the desire to purchase a vast number of slaves erupted. Europeans forced slaves to labor on coffee plantations, mines in Brazil, as well as sugar plantations across the Caribbean. The slave boom instantly became an opportunity for a massive transfer of wealth. Priests who originally came to the Congo to proselytize abandoned their evangelical missions to pursue basically unadulterated greed. They abandoned missions of evangelizing and did whatever they could to sell as many slaves as possible, and some of them even sold their own students who were Christian converts into slavery, which I find particularly cruel because they led people who they, you know, had built relationships with to their deaths crossing the Middle Passage potentially, and if those people did survive, they would be slaves, and those people who were allegedly men of God did so for their personal gain. So I want to give you a little excerpt from King Leopold's Ghost, which is one of the primary books I used to research the subject, to give you an understanding of how brutal and violent the capture and selling of slaves was on the African continent. Traders kept careful records of their booty. One surviving inventory from this region lists 68 head of slaves by name, physical defects, and cash value, starting with the men who were worth the most money and ending with child, name unknown as she is dying and cannot speak, male without value, and a small girl, Kalembo, no value because she is dying, one small girl, Kantumbe, no value because she is dying. So hearing these accounts and knowing that people who were African participated in the slave trade, it's not too difficult to, you know, sit there and ask yourself, who could do all of this to their own people? And how could someone allow this to happen to their people who considered themselves to be a leader? So, unlike European kings, Afonso I didn't inherit his throne through his parents. He's not, you know, a European monarch's fail son. He was chosen by a council of leaders who saw him fit to rule, and his words survive today, which is very interesting because we don't get a lot of written accounts from this time period, especially not from African people. Here are some of Afonso's words which survive today. When his rule began, nobody knew about white people, their religion, how many slaves they wanted, but by the time his rule ended, basically nothing in the region would ever be the same again. So he was a leader at a very transitional time for this part of the world. And so here are some excerpts from his writings. Each day the traders are kidnapping our people, children of this country, sons of our nobles and vassals, even people of our own family. This corruption and depravity are so widespread that our entire land is depopulated. We need in this kingdom only priests and school teachers and no merchandise unless it is wine and flour for mass. It is our wish that this kingdom not be a place for the trade or transport of slaves. Many of our subjects eagerly lust after Portuguese merchandise that your subjects have brought into our domains. To satisfy this inordinate appetite, they seize many of our black free subjects. They sell them, after having taken these prisoners to the coast, secretly or at night. As soon as the captives are in the hands of white men, they are branded with a red hot iron. So, even if there are accounts of the active participation of Africans in the slave trade, this certainly calls into question, in my opinion, some of the narratives about how wholehearted the support must have been, because these are his own words, which I think we can mostly trust. So Afonso I was a convert to Christianity, and he was often credited with making the Congo Kingdom a Christian kingdom, and he selectively appropriated technology and certain aspects of Portuguese colonization. So he wasn't universally accepting of all things Portuguese. He was a leader, and he actually really sought to be a leader to his people. He was definitely more interested in practical skills and church philosophy, but he was not interested in European bureaucracy, which, if you know anything about, you know, colonial history around the globe, is one of the main things that they've exported, and one of the reasons things like, you know, same-sex marriage is still illegal in places like the Caribbean. But this isn't what this is about today. So King Afonso basically was urged by the King of Portugal to adopt Portugal's legal code and court protocol, but he declined that offer. He also worked to keep out prospectors as best he could because he really worried that Europeans would enact a total takeover if they found the gold and silver that they coveted so dearly. During his rule, Afonso rebuilt the kingdom's capital using stone and new knowledge of masonry and woodworking gained from the Portuguese. He expanded the kingdom to the south and east and firmly established the Roman Catholic Church in the Congo. So we can see that Christianity in this area is going to have pretty early roots, at least relative to now, and that there was a little bit of an exchange in colonization that was effectively completely decimated by the fact that, you know, a large part of the population was stolen despite all of this. So the European takeover of the Congo wasn't due to Afonso's complete ignorance. He wasn't like a buffoon or even, you know, uniquely greedy. He recognized the problems the Portuguese brought with them, but he also saw the potential benefits of building a relationship with these strange people. He was an intelligent man, a diplomat, and he had an interest in building up his people and his kingdom. So it is my personal belief that he engaged willingly in the slave trade at first because slavery wasn't illegal, and at first it might have appeared like the demand was realistic. However, as time went on, and I think he began to see the true damage and the true intentions of the Portuguese, I believe that Zigmemba Afonso regretted some of his own actions and the freedom with which he allowed the Portuguese access to his kingdom. So the Portuguese didn't only engage in legal slave trade. They began kidnapping people, and as their greed rose, it became impossible for even the powerful king who had won battles and expanded his kingdom to stop the momentum of the frequent illegal kidnappings. Unfortunately, by the time Afonso put his thoughts into writing, the trajectory of the Congo Kingdom had already been sealed. In 1526, Afonso sent desperate letters to King João of Portugal, King João III of Portugal, urging him to control his own subjects and to respect the alliance that they'd forged and the common Catholic faith they shared that bound Europeans and Africans together. However, Afonso's letters and pleas went ignored. The slave boom spread throughout Europe, and now the Portuguese were not the only problem. The English, the French, and the Dutch arrived on the West African coast with an equal, if not greater, lust for human cargo. When they arrived, they found a civilization ravaged and destroyed by the slave trade, and they wrongfully assumed that nothing great could have ever existed there. Their bigoted beliefs met with confirmation bias, and they continued the plunder that the Portuguese had started. So with a weakened kingdom, other ethnic groups that kind of circled around the Congo Kingdom no longer had reason to pledge allegiance or offer allyship. It's one thing to want a strong ally, but no one really wants a weak ally. So in 1665, the weakened kingdom fought a battle against the Portuguese and lost, and this was effectively the end of the Congo Kingdom. By the 1800s, which is the time period where we'll really get into the details here, the Europeans had taken over completely. And, you know, you hear about that and it's easy to kind of just brush it off, but I really try to think of the human beings in that situation. What did that last battle feel like to the people who were there? They'd watched their daughters, their sons, their husbands, their fathers and mothers kidnapped, raped, and sold by a group of people who claimed sudden sovereignty over their land. And I wonder what those people felt as they fought for their freedom and they lost that freedom. And also, what would they feel if they knew that to this day, hundreds of years later, their descendants are still fighting? So now we are going to get into the man behind the genocide. I promised you a deep dive, and I'm starting from the bottom up because I really want to build out the story and flesh it out for you so you understand. And in this part, we are going to talk about King Leopold himself. And I'm going to read a segment from King Leopold's ghost again. "Above all," Leopold told his man in London, "I do not want to risk losing a fine chance to secure for ourselves a slice of this magnificent African cake." So, charming guy. So I learned visually, and when researching the subject, I encountered several pictures of King Leopold II, the Belgian king who will be one of the main subjects of this series. So at this point, we understand the condition of the Congo Kingdom when King Leopold's involvement began, basically a kingdom that was once great that had been ravaged by the transatlantic slave trade. And now I want to set the stage in Belgium so we can understand how this small country became involved in one of the largest genocides in human history. Because let's be real, Belgium? Really? Right? What has Belgium done? I mean, no shade if you're from Belgium, but they don't really give off strong colonizer energy the way France and England do. And that's definitely my West Indian bias talking. I also want to talk about later why this genocide has been forgotten, because I guarantee it's not for the reasons that you think. And I'm 97% sure that when we get to that part, you'll be like, you know, holy Moses. I don't think I have to bleep that if I say that. So there's a reason. So we're talking Belgium now. There's a reason we know so much about families like the Romanovs or even the Windsors of the United Kingdom, and we don't know much about King Leopold. And a part of that reason is what happened in the Congo. So the Belgian royal family still exists today. King Philippe of Belgium and his 18-year-old daughter, the incumbent Princess Elizabeth, are both direct descendants of King Leopold II. The family's wealth and status can be directly traced to the horrible crimes against humanity in the Congo. This is where we're going to get into the United Nations and crimes against humanity, to just fun, lighthearted subjects for the day. So the Convention on the Non-Applicability of Statutory Limitations to War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity was adopted and opened for signature, ratification, and accession by the United States General Assembly Resolution 2391 of the 26th of November, 1968. So, to distill that mouthful, this means that while no one can be arrested for crimes that happened generations before they were born, and I'm not suggesting they should be, It is theoretically possible that descendants of King Leopold II, who can trace their wealth to a decades-long crime against humanity, could be held financially accountable, if nothing else. So I'm trying to stick as much to the facts as possible in this video. If people are interested, and if I end up doing a Patreon in the future, I can disclose my cynical opinions there, let's just say. So this fact that there are potentially people living today who could be held financially accountable, if nothing else, connects to the apparent lack of information about the genocide in the Belgian Congo, but I promise we will get back to that in the series. We're going to go back a little bit more to King Leopold. I know I'm jumping, but I really hope that you are sticking with me and that you get something out of this, at least today's episode about King Leopold. So, King Leopold, scary looking man, and you can look up pictures of him, severe nose, angry looking shrew face, big beard, looks like he worships Odin, but definitely, probably most likely Catholic is my guess. And the way he's portrayed is very severe. That's how I would describe his face. And I wonder if he's portrayed this way for a reason. There's something regal about his official portraits, but there's also something dark and ominous, especially about the portraits taken in his later years. And given King Leopold II's obsession with status, it's really no surprise to me. At first, maybe it was, but reading more about him, it makes sense. His portraits reflect how he wanted us to see him: strong, masculine, powerful. Leopold II had a chip on his shoulder from the very beginning of his, ability to produce conscious thought. His identity as a Belgian always made him feel small and unimportant. There was both an air of superiority about him, as well as a deep preoccupation with his own perceived inferiority as a Belgian, especially considering some of his relatives were monarchs of empires that he might have envied not just for their status, but for their vast territories abroad. Belgium became a sovereign nation in 1830, rebelling against Holland and seeking a monarch to rule the fledgling nation. The German prince, Leopold I, was chosen to rule the country. He was married twice, his first wife giving birth to a stillborn baby, and then his second wife, Louise, la mère de Leopold, giving birth to four children. And the first of these children was Leopold II, so we got our young heir in the house. So Leopold I died at 74 after a 34-year rule. Pretty long stint. Leopold II became the next king of Belgium, and he would go on to rule Belgium for 44 years. These monarchs be living. During this time, King Leopold II would devastate Africa so greatly that the aftershocks are still felt throughout the region today. What a legacy. If this were a European-led world history class, we'd, I don't know, maybe give him a round of applause for good imperialism. But it's not that type of podcast. So what was King Leopold II's childhood like? How did this prince of a small and relatively new European nation go on to commit such atrocities? Why did this happen and how? So those are questions that we have about every major historical event. But when it comes to this one, we have one final question. And this one plagued me so much when I first started learning about this. And it's why the mystery, why the heck have we never heard of this? And the answer really, it really isn't as simple as we want to think it is. So I really hope to answer all of these questions for you in this entire series. So Leopold II's parents, so King Leopold I and Louise, we went over their love story. They preferred his younger siblings to him. Leopold was a gangly and awkward child and never really fit in with anyone growing up. You know that tweet that's like, "Oh, you complain about deadbeat dads, but what if the kid had bad vibes?" Leopold II was that kid with bad vibes. Real talk. He never fit in with anyone growing up. Several people who knew him had many negative things to say about him. Ungodly vibes. From what I read, I honestly got the impression that he was unlikable and weird. He was the sort of person who just had to make people uncomfortable. He had to have his way. He was standoffish, snobby, inappropriate, and it honestly didn't seem like he was socialized to get along with others pretty well. I mean, he was a prince, so I don't think it's a stretch to say that, like, he was raised to be entitled. He had a relatively lonely childhood, and I'm not trying to do this, you know, this poor, horrific loner couldn't help but commit war crimes. Wah. That's not why I'm saying that, but I mention it because I feel like he lacked the social connections in general that are important to building the sense of empathy and connectedness, and a sense that your actions impact others and that matters, and a true understanding of the innate wrongness of causing harm to others. Other events in his life also led to this lack of empathy, such as his military service, which I'll elaborate on shortly. Leopold II was a poor student, and his mother wrote him letters, which is so weird, complaining of his poor attention to his studies. Dear Leopold, your studies are quite bananas. I find it interesting that she wrote him letters, and I want to just point out how strange that is, but it perfectly characterizes the detachment that Leopold I and Louise had from their eldest son. He had people to ensure he was adequately schooled, but his parents were honestly not really involved unless they wanted to express their disapproval. While Leopold spoke French and German, languages of the noblesse, he never learned Flemish, which is a language associated with the lower classes in Belgium, but a language that 50% of the country spoke, so you might think it would be useful. When it came to his schooling, the only subject Leopold II ever showed any interest in was geography, which perhaps indicated his early interest in conquest for personal gain and the grandiosity that shaped his later years. From early on in his life, both his parents noticed there was something sly and sneaky about him. He used underhanded techniques to get his way, never revealing his true hand. Leopold II's first cousin, Queen Victoria of England, perceived him as, quote, very odd and in the habit of, quote, saying disagreeable things to people, which was funny to me when I read it. Like most male members of royal families, Leopold II had a military career. From the age of 10 on, Leopold was given military training, and by 15, he held the rank of lieutenant in the Belgian army, at 16, captain, at 18, major, at 19, colonel, and by the time he was 20, a major general. So, granted, I am referencing War and Peace here, but as I understand it, these titles are basically just for show. Princes get titles. They make decisions, they influence the lives of many, they may lead people to get injured, disabled, die, but they are distant from the line of fire. They are never at risk of being killed. You're not going to put your heir in front of a cannonball. Unless you're into that, which I don't think most monarchs are. So war was used as a tool by the wealthy to advance their careers and gain titles, massive wealth accumulation, such as, you know, conquered lands and whatnot. And they never had to actually do the dirty work. They wouldn't have to ever suffer war injuries that might leave them amputees or kill them. And Leopold II's military career was most likely exactly like that. He gained medals and epaulettes and sashes, but I mean, he was 16. Like, they weren't putting their 16-year-old heir in the line of fire. I don't believe it for a second. But this military service meant that he learned from a young age that civilians and basically people were expendable, and due to who he was, men would not only die for him, they would kill for him. And I think that's an important connection to make, especially considering he did a genocide. When Leopold II turned 18, in order to forge an alliance with Austria-Hungary, his parents betrothed him to a Habsburg princess, Marie Henriette, and they did not get along. People perceived Marie Henriette as loud, crude, and melodramatic, and she perceived Leopold II as cold and unappealing, and I cannot really blame her. Like, he did go on to commit a genocide. He must have, I mean, can we say he's a whack job? I don't know. That's definitely an opinion. He was allegedly a whack job. I'm alleging it. He would go long periods of time without talking to his spouse at all. They shared no common interests. Queen Victoria had to drop the tea, and she was like, she thought they were a poor match. And Leopold II wanted to break away from his wife and found every opportunity to go their separate ways. And this is important because this basically gave him time to plot. Leopold II, after his marriage, traveled often. His lust for expansion grew. He was especially frustrated at how small Belgium was. It was just such a tiny kingdom. And I'm not going into these details to kind of like, you know, linger too long on European monarchy in episode one of a Black History podcast. But because I really need it, we need to get inside his mind. We're getting into his brain so we can understand the psychology and the political situation that enabled him to commit the genocide in the Congo. So let's unlock his brain. He was satisfied not just with his small country, but with the small people. And he would say this phrase, petit pays, petit gens, which basically, you know, he thought they were pathetic people, and it expressed not just his personal dissatisfaction, but his classism. And he didn't speak a language that 50% of the people in his country spoke. He definitely thought, you know, that he was above them and that they were not enough to rule. So this classism yielded to his grandiose visions and ultimately his entitlement to enact those visions. And this is one major way the genocide we're going to talk about differs from some more contemporary genocides. The fact that this genocide happened demonstrates the sheer power of one man's entitlement and the dangers of power concentrated in the hands of a single individual. Now, of course, King Leopold did not personally kill 10 million people. When we learn about areas like Nazi Germany, for example, you kind of get the idea that there's this culture that's fomenting genocide. And the same with the Rwandan genocide, which I will most likely do a series on because I've studied it in detail and I need to get it all out. But it's one man, and it's the concentration of power in a single individual. And this will become so clear how this was just his whim, especially in the next episode. Before King Leopold was 20, before he was king, he traveled the world because he was looking for ways to expand Belgium's role in world trade. And he was basically pitching Belgium's potential to be a world leader, and nobody took him seriously. Belgium was barely older than Leopold himself, and it certainly wasn't worthy of competition with France or England on the world stage. Leopold eventually traveled to Sevilla in Spain at 26, which is the age I am now, in case you're curious, and he dedicated himself to his newest passion, profits. The great capitalism striketh once again. And he learned about profits and how to extract them by bastions of morality throughout the world, Spanish conquistadors. And in case it's not coming across, they were not bastions of morality. They were, will I have to censor bastards? I don't know. Much like later genocidaires studied eugenics in America to enact their plans, Leopold studied the writings of Spain's looters and profiteers, the people given accolades by the Spanish and Portuguese monarchs for their genocide against the indigenous people of the West Indies and South America. Some really great guys to model your life after. He couldn't get enough of studying their works. He became obsessed, and the obsession made him restless. He didn't only want to study the logs and accounts of the Spaniards and the Portuguese, who didn't only reach the Caribbean and South America, but who had also plundered the west coast of Africa. This fit in nicely with Leopold II's grandiose fantasies of gaining territory and riches for Belgium. He wanted a slice of the magnificent African cake. I know I've read a few excerpts, but I'm only reading ones that I think are, like, you know, quotes to put in your brain and said by someone who, you know, probably got paid to write this book, unlike me, who's doing this for free for some reason. And this is a little analysis of King Leopold from the book. Leopold's letters and memos, forever badgering someone about acquiring a colony, seem to be in the voice of a person starved for love as a child and now filled with an obsessive desire for an emotional substitute. The way someone becomes embroiled in an endless dispute with a brother or sister over an inheritance or with a neighbor over a property boundary. This is where we are more or less going to leave off today. We understood the conditions of what's going on in the Congo, and we understand a little bit more of the background on the man who is going to commit this entire genocide. In part two, we're going to set up the machine for how this genocide came to pass, the different players, and also what every good grift has, the whistleblowers who went ignored. We're not even close to the end of the story, as you can tell, but I don't really want to make this, you know, 3 hours long in one go. So there is going to be a part two. I promise you, you're going to want to soak this all up. So re-listen to this again if you need to kind of keep all the details in your mind. I promised a deep dive, and so this is a deep dive, I swear. And we're going to talk about how 8 to 10 million people were killed in a colonial project begun and maintained by King Leopold of Belgium to enrich Belgium on the backs of the Congolese people. The Belgian Congo was controlled by King Leopold II, a sovereign nation of his own outside of Belgium, where he could extract as much profit as he wanted without any form of oversight. So in part two, to give you a little teaser, we're going to discuss more of what happened in the Congo, the U.S. involvement in supporting King Leopold's genocide in the Belgian Congo. So I have nowhere for you to follow me right now. Seriously, like, we're at the end and I don't know what to tell you. So subscribe to the podcast and listen to the next one, and hopefully I'll have a page of some sort, and I hope I don't get coerced into making a Twitter, but we'll see. So subscribe to the podcast and come back for part two, because we're going to keep talking about the Belgian Congo.